Blue Book non-disclosure agreement.
Take your time, read it over.
The signee agrees to regular data audit with unlimited access to confirm that no disclosure of information has taken place in public or private forms using any means of communication, including but not limited to that which is disclosed orally or in written or electronic form. I think I need a lawyer.
It's standard.
It doesn't feel very standard.
Okay, it's not standard. What can I tell you, Caleb? You don't have to sign it. You know, we can spend the next few days just shooting pool, getting drunk together, bonding. And when you discover what you've missed out on in about a year, you're gonna regret it for the rest of your life. Good call. So, do you know what the Turing test is?
Yeah, I know what the Turing test is. It's when a human interacts with a computer. And if the human doesn't know they're interacting with a computer, the test is passed.
And what does the pass tell us?
That the computer has artificial intelligence. Are you building an AI?
I've already built one. And over the next few days, you're gonna be the human component in the Turing test.
Holy shit.
Yeah, that's right, Caleb. You got it. Because if that test is passed, you are dead center of the greatest scientific event in the history of man.
If you've created a conscious machine, it's not the history of man. That's the history of gods.
Welcome to I Know Movies, and you don't. That's with me, your host, Kyle Brule. And if you're joining us this season, it's only a little bit different. And I keep explaining it every episode, but season 10 is Dealer's Choice. And it's sort of just turning the tables, turning the focus away from my vanity, my control of the project, and the seasons and how I put them all together, but giving it back, the control, the choice, to my guests who have been, you know, coming along the journey ever since season one. I couldn't have done it without them. I've had over 50 people, and so not even all the voices are going to be featured on this season. It just depends on availability and schedule, and it's been great to have all of the varied conversations, all the varied choices, because they are reflective of their personal journeys, their personal tastes, and honestly, that's what film's all about. It's about this engagement with the project, engagement with different genres, engagement with different storytelling ideas and characters, the ones that speak to us, the ones that last, the ones that reflect maybe something of our own feelings of the world and how we want the world to be. And that's part of this process. And so Dealer's Choice is about the guests. And joining me today is someone who's been on only once before, but we've tried many times. And it's because he's actually like working in this industry and doing it. And he had
a really good time when I was here.
Yeah, I'm glad. We talked Batman Returns yes. for Christmas episodes. That was a couple years ago, but Steve Shimmick, welcome back to the show. You are a working director in this industry of ours.
And I am.
It's always very impressive. It's always very fun to get invited to see things you've done. You've worked with Katie, my fiance, and Christy is your wife, and she's an editor, and you work with her too often. Yeah. But welcome back to the show. How are you?
Thank you. Thanks for having me. No, I'm doing well. Yeah, I'm doing really well. I just wrapped up, actually just today, delivered what I hope to be the final master files for The latest project, The Magician's Raincoat, a Halloween movie.
Magician's Raincoat. Yeah. I love it.
It's a cute little kids movie that has witches in it and a raincoat and a magician.
No, well, I mean, at least it's not going to be accused of false advertisement.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, you're constantly working. You're working on these things. And you do, I mean, the hats you wear. It's like you are a director, but you're involved oftentimes in the writing process, you're involved in post process, putting it all together, effects shots. I mean, yeah. We were just talking about that prior to your recording. I mean, you do so much in this, and it's so impressive.
I appreciate you saying that. I don't. I'm not the best at taking compliments, but thank you. I think of it in a different frame of mind sometimes when I find myself, because I do take on a lot of post. I take on a lot of visual effects work for these movies because they don't have the budgets to do not only just the number of shots that we would like to have in these films, but like at a certain quality level that I would like to see in the films.
Yeah.
And so I keep telling myself that it'll be worth it in the long run to have put the time in myself, and who knows if it's any better, but there are certainly more hours put in. And it's one of the big reasons I've not been able to be on the show as much is just because I keep locking myself in a closet and finishing these movies.
Just grinding it in. Yeah. I mean, that's it's almost like what it takes. You know,
is it wise? I don't know.
Well, that's not for us to say. It's not for, not for me to say. Maybe for your own self, you can make that determination. It's interesting you've picked a movie with a lot of effects shots. I think it was 850 effects shots.
Beautiful, too, though. Anyway, not to get it ahead of ourselves.
We can talk a little bit about it.
Lovely visual effects in that film. And it's incredible. The type of anamorphic lenses they're shooting on, too, the degree of distortion and chromatic aberration that you're dealing with just to get the visual effects to look like they were captured in camera.
Yeah.
Like you're always doing that.
Yes.
But it's tougher on anamorphics, and it just looks lovely, and it still does. I don't know how old the movie is, actually.
2014. It's going to be 10 years this
almost
year.
Almost 10 years old.
I think it came out in April of 2014. Okay. I think it was one of those A24 spring releases. They never know what to do with these things.
Yeah.
I think, you know, sci-fi and especially high concept sci-fi tends to land in a very peculiar realm, even though it's highly respected amongst people who do see them. Like, I mean, this is kind of a cult sensation.
It's
like,
true. I was actually, when I was looking it over again, I was like, it's kind of an underappreciated movie. People don't talk about it the way that they talk about other films. And it's like, it's actually a very engaging narrative, and it has a lot to say.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. It's like watching three people play three-dimensional chess with each other. And that's how complicated a piece it is. It's a really fully realized movie. I remember when I first saw it, it blew me away. It blew me away in its frankness, but also its subtlety. And it was that balancing act. And I think, we'll be talking about, everyone sees the title of it. We'll be talking about Alex Garland's directorial debut, Ex Machina, today. This is kind of like pre-conversation to the main conversation. I think Alex Garland is one of the most impressive, unique voices in cinema working today. And I think that ranges not only from his screenwriting, and it goes all the way back from his novel, The Beach, getting adapted in a collaboration with Danny Boyle, which introduces him to do 28 Days Later, Sunshine, he does Never Let Me Go, Dread, and then directorial. Some people say he ghost directed Dread. I mean, we talked about that in season 5. But this is like his official directorial debut. And ever since, with every piece from Annihilation to Television with Devs, I even think Men is a pretty extraordinary piece. I think he's a really incredible filmmaker. And how do you feel about Alex Garland?
Oh, I agree. Relatively uncompromising and a voice that I would want to say something along the lines of maybe just a perspective and an approach to sci-fi that we don't get often enough. It's the sort of thing that, like we were talking about, I think maybe due to the nature of this high concept sci-fi not going as far, it's the sort of thing where like, I appreciate any attempt at bringing more to the conversation and let alone doing it extremely well. I think that we could do with more attention to the his dedication to bringing new things to sci-fi, and at least it's living in this world that we all find to be, I think, the more interesting side of science fiction. There's a lot, there's a lot of marketability in science fiction, and it's become a popular genre in a way that doesn't make room for these kinds of stories most of the time.
Yeah.
So anytime someone is, you know, working so hard at bringing great stories to this really cerebral kind of approach to what science fiction can offer, I very much appreciate
it. Yeah, me as well. Like the way he is able to really hone in on theory, but also enhance it in a sense of that contemplation. And it's a contemplation as he moves the characters who are fully realized and felt through that, the potency of it. It's so potent, it's so realized, and because it's uncompromising, because it is an attempt to distill something of our reality and something that he's warning about, but also maybe like warning from different angles. It's like, he's not going to provide you with the right answer. Right. It's like, I'm going to present you with the feelings and the process of it. And now it's up to you to make some kind of decision based off of what you've just, what has unfolded and what in practice. And it's really mature stuff.
It's true. And that's something that I think people are afraid to do, particularly after you go through rounds of studio notes, when you are trying to include as much ambiguity in your story as possible and not connect all the dots for your audience so that they can have whatever experience they're going to have with the material.
Yeah.
I think it's nice. It's refreshing, and I applaud any attempts to go in that direction.
Yeah, no, and it sits on a great foundation. I mean, we can take like AI and its like contemplative sci-fi elements all the way back to like Stanley Kubrick, and maybe even slightly before, if you look at maybe works of like Harlan Ellison and Philip K. Dick, and Arthur C. Clarke, and what they imagined. That's only in like a third of the film of 2001: A Space Odyssey is that kind of contemplation. It links to this whole idea of technology and evolution and human condition as it develops through that lens. But then we have in Ex Machina, it travels and enhances because technology has only done that. It has only evolved. It has only gotten more complex. And it's through those complexities that I think it is a fascinating work. And so I'm going to be really excited to talk about it. It's one of my favorite movies in the last century. I think it is a stunning piece. But let's take it back. Let's get to know Steve Shimek just a little bit. And, I've been asking all of my guests, Where did their love of movies come from, generally? Because I've always told people that it was a combination, but that I was raised on movies. I mean, it was just kind of regular in the household, not only in a sense of the television was always on or the VHS player always had a tape in it, but my mother would watch TCM. I would be introduced to a variety of movies, not only through television programming, VHS rental, but also just my mother, being involved. And so as a family, we would engage in movies in that way. What's your story? How did you come into loving movies? Was it at an early age?
I guess I haven't really spent a lot of time trying to dissect it. And there's always been a storytelling element to my family. As far back as I can remember, particularly on my mother's side, everyone was constantly developing and embellishing family stories. And that's sort of how the history of, who we were and who, like, that's, I've, so many family stories, and that's what family gatherings were about, is like reminiscing and the way that they all enjoyed telling the stories and listening to the stories was, thinking about it now, kind of like foundational to what became important to me.
Yeah.
Because when I was really little, I thought I wanted to be an archaeologist, but I really wanted to be Indiana Jones, in love with Indiana Jones. And then I wanted to be a paleontologist, but I really was just into Jurassic Park specifically. Mm-hmm. And I started realizing that my dramatic attachment to future career choices was driven so much by what I had seen in cinema that what I really enjoyed was exploring these stories that I thought were exciting and interesting.
Gotcha.
And so I think I made my first film at like age 6, but my dad wouldn't let me hold the camera. And of course, as any responsible adult should do, I took him into the backyard. I dressed up my younger brother and sister, and we ran through the bushes, and we were going on this jungle adventure that made no sense. And eventually my dad cut it off and was like, all right, that's enough. And then I started thinking, okay, well, I need to know where the story's going.
Yeah.
And so then the next movie I made was a sequel to The Rocketeer, and I had I had built a helmet out of cardboard and kind of decorated a backpack and done my best to kind of figure out exactly where the story should go. I'd written the credits on paper with crayon, misspelled everything. And it just started becoming a thing where my dad finally was like, here, you take the camera. So then it was like stop motion with my sister's Barbies or, you know, and never very respectfully.
Mm-hmm.
These Barbies were going through a lot. They were going through car crashes and they were being blown up and things.
But, there need to be more of that in the Barbie movie. I know they had the weird ones, but there have been abused and burned Barbie carcasses, all throughout history. I know that one's trying to be a little more kind to the world, the imaginary world of Barbie, but they have been mistreated.
Screen accurate Barbie car crash, though, I think. Yeah. And so I guess what came later was the idea that you could do it for a living. Right.
Yeah.
This was what I was doing for fun. I kept on trying to figure out how to do it better. I got obsessed with, I grew up, I was born in 84. And so a lot of the television programming that I was super into was behind the scenes of movies that were going to be coming out. And I would study those shows and then try to recreate the special effects. And so for the longest time, I thought I wanted to be a stuntman. And then I thought I wanted to be a special effects guy. And then, you know, like all of it was interesting to me. And it wasn't until I was 13 or 14 and I was at, I discovered a junior high class that you could take that was just technology, but mostly like media technology.
Okay. Yeah.
And they had a, Mr. Piggott was the teacher's name, and I became obsessed with his, he had an entire tape-based edit suite that was, to my memory and from what I could tell, like production grade, like, broadcast usually uses Betacam.
Yeah,
this was
all
VHS-based, but it was all the same kind of frame accurate, like heavy-duty stuff. And I would spend my lunches in there. I would spend time after school in there, just being the world's biggest nerd, because it, believe it or not, there was a time when like making videos with your friends was not a popular thing to do.
No, it was not. It was not. It was hard to do. Yeah, I was in a class with a few people in like 6th through 8th grade. And we were the nerds. Like we were we were nerds. We wanted to film things. We wanted to be part of it. And we the whole method of the class was to shoot things throughout the year to make like a video yearbook by the end. And while we didn't edit it, we were invited into the process to watch all of our footage get coordinated, organized, and then put, and we got to be part of the choices. And it's, it was very exciting, very exciting. But, definitely, we were not being invited to the lunch tables to explain our methodology and what we were doing in our classes.
this class opened my eyes to the idea that you could actually, like, this was like there were professionals that did this. And I don't know why my smooth little brain hadn't put two and two together before then.
Movies are magic. Yeah. Like, we feel as though they are like some sort of capturing essence from some other world that exists, and that's to its credit. And I think we are all convinced of that.
It's, you know, true. And I grew up in a really, really small town where all my friends had agricultural backgrounds, and we were the transplants. My dad was a computer programmer that worked at the local rocket factory. What would you call that place? They build the propulsion engines for like the space shuttle and such. But like, I was the only kid I knew who had a computery dad.
Uh-huh.
And but he was also into AV. And so when I was the kid, even when I was still in the single digits, that people would talk to when it was like, oh, the TV is blue, what do I do? And I'd have to go like, you know, put everything correctly so that they could watch television. You know, that was my value, I guess.
My dad was like that too. I wouldn't call him the tech savvy person. I mean, but he is, because he's just interested in technology. And so I think he just knows a little about a lot. Yeah. And that has been the consistency. Like when we got our first computer and we had like dial up internet, he was like walking me through the process and trying to explain it to me.
And I was into it. My dad was doing the same thing. And I was the ideal audience for a father who wanted to just talk about how it worked. Because I also felt like a need. Like one of the greatest traits that I learned from my father is he's a very thorough troubleshooter.
Mm-hmm.
And he will get to the bottom of whatever the problem is and then fix it at that stage. Instead of treating the symptom, he's going to dig in, figure out what the technical problem is.
Wow.
And so that was a huge part of my growing up and a huge part of me being able to tinker my way toward having my own tiny little, you know, tape based edit suite. And
I'm seeing like connective tissue here, because like you watch these movies and you apply this kind of like obsessive fascination to like archaeology or paleontology. And it seems as it grows, when you're introduced to like piece by piece, your need for understanding or your just desire to understand, you put your full self into it. I think that's great. That's fascinating.
Because one of the things, speaking of obsessing over the tiny details, I remember watching, because I had at this point, we all probably start in camera editing. I got to get this angle, and I'm going to go shoot that one. I'm going to come back and shoot the reverse of this one. And then I started, you know, being like, oh, well, I could do this on the VCR. And I convinced my dad to get me a VCR that could audio dub and video insert. It was the family VCR, but it was, I used it the most. But then I started becoming obsessed, because I would watch movies and television, and I would watch the intercut, and you'd see person A talking, and you'd cut to person B, and without any interruption, you would continue hearing person A talking, and then cut back to person A again, and they're still seamlessly in the middle of the same conversation. And that's what I started obsessing over, and that was one of the reasons for the audio dubbing VCRs. I was like, I have to be able to do that, though.
Wow.
I need to be able to have the conversation overlap and it was from there. I was probably a junior in high school by the time we finally got a computer that could handle video editing.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's when everything changed, because all of the things I could obsess about, I suddenly had like a janky tool that could kind of sort of do that.
Pretty much.
I saw
if you forced it.
I saw Hollow Man and instantly started wandering around the house in a sheet and filming myself and then like throwing the sheet. And then I would painstakingly remove myself frame by frame with like a paint program. So I would get all the frames digitized, paint myself out, and then see if I'd done a good enough job that it looked like, you know. Because in my mind, I was like, I should be able to do this. I should be able to make a movie that looks as good as Hollywood. And I couldn't understand the limitations of the tools that I had. Like, I didn't know enough about camera equipment to realize that my Sony Handycam will never look like a cinema camera.
But
I did get far enough to realize that if I back this camera way the hell up and I zoom it all the way in, that somehow the depth of field gets shallower. And, you know, like, I'm doing everything I can to get closer.
Pushing it to the limit. Yeah. Yeah. No, and that's fascinating.
Just convinced that I could make it look like Hollywood.
Was it as good as Hollow Man?
No. there were brief moments where it works, and then there's a little wiggle, and then, you know, it's that sort of thing where, like, it worked well enough for me to keep trying and keep doing more.
Yes. Yeah.
And you know, so I eventually got to the point where I was animating. I spent so much time, just because of you know, my siblings at this point have lives of their own. I can't boss them around anymore.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm setting up a camera in the corner and doing some dumb thing by myself, and then I'm adding a dinosaur that eating me or something.
That's,
you know,
fun. My goodness, and this is all before college.
That's
wild. That's great. That's fantastic.
And it's what got me my first job at college, because I had all of this random ass footage. I had taken, there was an old piece of exercise equipment that my dad was going to throw away, and I was like, don't throw that away. And I rejiggered it to make myself like a 360 camera rig, so I could start shooting like spinning panoramic shots. Never had a project to do that with.
Yeah.
But I would shoot stuff with myself and spin the camera around me, and I would do like Matrix-y looking bullet shots and stuff.
Amazing.
I built a crane out of a different piece of exercise equipment that was getting thrown out. A lot of old 70s exercise equipment that was being purged at the time. And so by the time I was going to college, I had the world's most random demo reel.
Yeah.
I had started experimenting with motion capture. Like, I had found a website that had some really limited motion capture files and applied them to like these, like a baby, you know, and there's this baby like dancing next to a skeleton, next to a robot.
Very Ally McBeal.
Yes. It was a very, very influenced by everything that happened in the 1990s. I'm like, I could do that. But so my first boss, Mark Phillips, who produced segments for local television and hired college students to help him produce these like public interest pieces, hired me. And it wasn't until we were out on a job one time and just talking about whatever that I started talking about when I applied for the job. And he was like, you know, Steve, there was somebody more qualified than you that applied at the same time, but that demo reel, it was 17 minutes long. And I thought, anybody that wants, like, that is this into it and wants to do it this badly, you know, like, I should give him a chance.
I love that.
So
you're just doing everything you can. I'm glad someone saw it. Yeah. You know, that's great.
No, he was great. And I learned so much at that job. It was my first introduction to Final Cut Pro.
Oh yeah.
Back in those days, it was a real piece of software that you could use.
I liked it a lot.
Yeah. And it plugged right into the production process. Yeah. You know, there's a whole pipeline that you need to be familiar with if you're going to do it with the big boys. And I had used this Chinese software that actually was so confusing for the longest time, because the layer stack was reversed. So the bottom layer was at the top. And then if you wanted footage on top of that, you had to go to the layer below it.
Oh my goodness.
And so I had learned, unbeknownst to me, my first nonlinear editing system had taught me an upside down version of the workflow.
Okay. Yeah.
And so, I mean, it took a little getting used to. It wasn't that bad, but I was blown away by the fact that I could play it back without rendering.
Oh, yeah.
That was the mind blowing experience there.
Yeah. That's incredible. So, I know there, we don't have to go into the two details of like the college experience, because I know there's a long story about like you actually made a movie during college.
Yes.
But I'm more interested in what did you learn and to apply, and what spoke to you? Because you have this background that you're just learning by yourself, and you're doing all these things, you're pushing it to the limit of your creativity, and for the technical aspects of what's at your disposal, you go into college knowing a lot, but also now you have to apply it in a different way. And it's you now are amongst a community of people who think of things either similarly to you or now you can work with. And so now it puts your skills in a whole different kind of setting. What did you end up learning through the process of working with others and applying like your vision or your ideas, and then what other people had to offer into the expansion of it? Like what do other creatives to you have a value in the process of creativity?
Yep. Yeah, I think there's a lot of value in working your way towards this position, be a director, I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it encompasses so much. And I accidentally directed my first movie, my freshman year in college or my sophomore year in college, maybe somewhere in between.
That's crazy.
I know. And I was trying to produce it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had not gotten into the film program yet, but I thought I'll just go to this class. Because there was this producer symposium class that was like Thursday nights or something. And it was, from what I could tell, one of the only classes I could go to where someone had actually made a film and was in the middle of distributing a second. And they were trying to teach you the business side of how to get a movie made.
Okay. Yeah.
And so there was a lot in that class to learn, and I was very involved. And I spoke openly with the producer that was teaching.
Yeah, sure.
Let him know. I was like, I'm not in the program. They told me that I couldn't take this class, but can I just sit here? And he's like, that's fine. He didn't care.
Yeah. Yeah. Why would he?
Exactly. The more you get to know film people, you're like, he's not going to care. So it was phenomenal. And then he and his business partner, they're so into impossible ideas of like, what's a new, fresh way to do this?
Yeah.
That we can do without X problem or Y problem, and how can we, you know, do it differently so that. And so at that time, the concept that he was toying with was the idea of producing an action movie for $30,000. And I was like, that's more money than I've ever worked with in my life.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm all about this. Let me be a part of it. But no one else in the class was interested. Everyone was like, that's impossible, you know.
It's an impossibility.
And I was just like, let's do it. So I started meeting with him outside of that class. We started trying to develop something that wasn't very good. And then around Christmas time, I had already met Chrissy at this point, and we were hanging out at a mutual friend's house. And I got an email that was like, oh, you know what? If we instead pivot to a fantasy movie, I think I could get you like $50,000. And I was like, $50,000? Sold. Because I was basically a Looney Tunes character just walking out over the Grand Canyon, and I hadn't looked down yet, you know?
Yep.
So I was still marching forward and continued that all the way through the process, including when we couldn't find a director because everyone was uninterested in the material and the budget.
Well,
and
So
it's this thing where it's like, God, I had found the best cinematographer at our university at the time, and he was definitely interested to have access to more gear to really showcase, you know, what he's capable of.
Yeah.
I just couldn't find a director. And so I finally was like, I'll just direct it, I guess. And boy, was that a learning experience.
I mean, it's like, it really is jumping into the fire.
It's jumping into the deep end of like shark infested water, because this has become a favorite thing of mine, by the way. And I think it's because of this experience, but like I started picking up on the trash talking that was happening on set about how this director doesn't know what the hell he's doing and how shitty things are going. And so I started, at first you're like hurt, but then you're like, nah, I think there's truth in what's being said here. And it's at least a truer barometer for like how everybody feels, because something that nobody tells you is that your job as a director is not a purely creative job. And that's not how it started in the industry either.
Sure. Yeah.
The auteur theory has upended the idea of what a director's job is.
Yeah. Yeah. And the journeyman versus the artist, or exactly. and that there's a whole gray area in between the two.
But regardless of like what, how you see yourself, a big part of your job is managing people.
Yeah.
Because if
yeah.
you want to get what you want out of that project, you're not going to realize your vision if you cannot manage people.
Yeah.
And so one of the biggest lessons on that show for me was just the, this is what it is. This is what it's like. Here are all the people that think you're a piece of shit. And here's how, you know, you could have done it differently. Mm-hmm. I guess that's the negative takeaway. it has a very fond place in my heart, because at the time, the Red Camera didn't drop until I think the next year, or was that might've been like a beta version
wow.
of the Red Camera. Yeah. So for distributors to take it seriously, we had to shoot on 35 millimeter. And it's to this date the only film I've ever shot on 35
millimeter. That's insane.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it was golden. I'm glad I did it, as much as I question whether I should have.
Well, honestly, you know, that's the time of youth, right? Is yeah. to have that sort of, it's this wonderful bit of naivete, mm-hmm. and I would lean more in calling it innocence.
Sure.
To just taking it on, like to yeah. saying, you know what, I can, you know, I will. Mm-hmm. And honestly, you know, the older we get, those like that like risk aversion starts kind of creeping into our head with every sort of decision, and it's with everything. It's financial things. It's jobs. It's if the older you get, if you aren't in a relationship, like the hesitation and the questions linger.
Yeah.
Risk that the idea of risk and taking it on at your youth. I mean, that was such a, I mean, insane opportunity. And it sounds like you look back in a sense of positivity in the ways that you must, in the right. ways that you right. should, because I'm sure you learned a hell of a lot.
Oh yeah. I guess that's where I was trying to get to.
Yeah.
So philosophy early on was like, so first and foremost, the thing that I was the most obsessed with was, how do I make this look like a real movie? Mm-hmm. 'Cause that was, the first thing I remember talking to my neighbors at the time, because Chrissy and I had just gotten married and we lived in a tiny apartment, and our neighbors were also going to college, and they were like, what do you guys do? And I'm like, well, we make movies. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. And one time we were hanging out at our place, and they wanted to like see something we'd done, and we put it on, and they were like, oh, you make real movies. And I thought that was the most fascinating statement.
Yeah.
You make italics real mm-hmm. movies, you know, like I was like, okay. So like a big part of what I had experienced in that interaction was the fact that like I had hired the right cinematographer for this project. We had put enough effort into it. It looked like a real movie. What else is a real movie made of? Mm-hmm. And that's been the quest. Is to be objective enough with your own work to keep poking holes in the spots that don't look like a real movie.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny that you use that italicized definition of it, because I feel like that's how most people outside of people in the industry would recognize what you mean by making movies, that there is a kind of standard. There uh-huh. is a kind of look that we have been accustomed to yeah. visually. And my film school, I went to Loyola Marymount, was all about that. That's their main foundation. I kind of bucked against it because I was more of an avant-garde experimentalist.
Sure.
And so I didn't necessarily care that it looked like a movie. I just wanted to be weird. And so I've come to terms with, you know, what are my proclivities, and then what we mean by this, because that there is, I mean, when you go to the cinema every week, there is a kind of standard gloss, a standard idea visually of what we mean by movie making.
Yeah. But there is a broader, because that's kind of like the compass that I hold, I guess. But I think it applies to a broad range of aesthetics as long as they are consistently presented and motivated.
Yeah. Yes.
And then you get into, you know, what does a real movie sound like? What is the range of that? What does a real movie story feel like? What does real movie dialogue sound like? And so, like, it's all in the cracks and crevices of, you know, we passed that first speed bump and got cinematography that felt like it wasn't a home movie or whatever.
Yeah.
And now it's time to dig into the rest of it and really kind of explore. So I guess, what would you call that? Just the bar to clear. That's always like, because I have worked with low budgets of all sorts.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And that's always like a, whenever, my one piece of advice, whenever someone comes to me and says, what would be your advice to a director? I'm always like, because I know what people are looking for. They want like someone to tell them the secret that they haven't been able to discover yet.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not secrets. You know, no one has like the secret. Here's how you find success. But I try to tell them things that like I didn't realize were a bigger deal than they are. They seemed. And so my piece of advice is always kind of a bummer and no one likes it. But I tell them that like if I were only able to give you one piece of advice as a director, it would be you need to be able to compromise wisely. You need to know how, where, and confidently, like where and how to compromise.
Yeah.
Because that's the game.
It is.
It's like, well, we can't do that. So what are we doing instead?
Or yeah.
This didn't work. So how do we do it? And
That ability to adapt to the situation. Uh-huh. But the word is, I think, what depresses people. Is
yes.
Compromise.
Yeah.
But honestly, what is life if not compromise? Sure. I mean, that was the art of politics is compromise, uh-huh. You know? And if you think of it in those terms, then that really trickles down and applies to pretty much everything, because politics, not in the absolute sense, but the act of politics and politicking goes into every form of business, relationships, uh-huh. and all of it. It is all a matter of balance and compromise, and you have to make those kinds of sacrifices. It's just what it is. I mean, George Lucas had made tons of compromises and sacrifices on making Star Wars. Not that people can necessarily tell or say that they see them, but he had to make a lot of accommodations to make that movie happen.
Yeah.
And honestly, it is a kind of application across the way to when you have to problem solve. Sometimes it is about what can we do in this situation versus the other, and it will throw something of your ideals of how the project should be out the window.
Absolutely. And in many cases, if you're doing it correctly, the film will be better for it.
Sure. Yeah.
You have to have that fertile ground to let things grow and change and shift, and you're never going to be able to pluck your platonic ideal out of the ether and put it on the screen. Yeah. And if you could, would it feel real?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Because it's like, it's that effort of getting as close as you could and then discovering things along the way that I think is a big part of the magic.
Absolutely. Well, and you've applied all these lessons and you continue to apply them. Like you said, you just wrapped up another film and I've seen two of your films.
Okay.
at this point, you know, Invitation to a Murder. And, we got to sit down with you for, the fantasy one.
Oh gosh, you did.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, you got to show me that one.
Thank you for sitting through that movie.
But we got to. I've seen what you're and I know that there are more. I've been instructed to watch like K-9 and other things.
That's one of Katie's favorites.
And what is it about a project? And I know you don't necessarily have too much control, you know, because you work with some people and they're giving you a script that they are working on that they're thinking of you to partner with. But You've worked in a variety of genres, murder mystery, I can think of, you know, fantasy, children's adventure, horror. And there is an avenue of every project has a striking, you know, difference to it all. But what do you see as the similarities when you are approaching it as a director? You know, what are the kind of methodologies you apply to storytelling, and what do you hone in on, you know, as a director, and what you focus on in order to tell each different genre in its own way?
Yeah. So far, something I've found to be really important is that there has to be, I need to find something to fall in love with, or I will not be able to give it what it needs. Like, filmmaking is so hard that if you're not fighting to accomplish something that you have some sort of love for, it's going to be impossible.
Yeah.
You can get to the finish line.
Sure.
But it's not going to be pretty for anyone. And so the first thing I will do when I read the script is let myself just instinctively and naturally respond to the material and see where the thing is that I could love. Even if I need to like do a little zhuzhing to really, really love it.
Yeah.
I've got to find that thing. And then that's
where... is it different every time?
It is. But it's almost always some form, character connection, human experience. There will also be frequently like a tone, whether it's for a scene or for even the film overall. If there's like... this last one that I did, by the way, one of my caveats, because the producers wanted to have me on, but it was a bit of a price cut, and they knew that it was going to be hard work, and I was like, I had two caveats, but one of them was, can we make it a Halloween movie? And they were like, yeah. And I was like, then I'm in.
there it is.
I will make a Halloween movie of almost any kind. But there's, for me, I guess the most important thing about any script is whether or not I, care about the people, or if I can find some person to be like, I want this to work out for you, or I want, like, you're reading the story and you can respond to someone. It's not necessarily the protagonist. Even you can fall in love with any of the people and try and find a way to make that surface. But I find that what I'm always looking for is like, what in this story, what in this, even if it's just like a moment, there's like this film hinges on this thing, or maybe it's even like a scene that's not as important, but like it's important to me.
Yeah.
There's like a little shiny golden nugget that I'm like, this is the thing that we're going to be working toward. And that's the important thing. Cause again, sorry, I'm all over the place.
No.
But there were, especially on low budget movies, you have to budget your time in a way that feels like hurting the other scenes.
Sure.
And you need to know going into your day which scenes can take the beating and which ones need that.
That's time interesting. And that nurturing. I think that's true.
And because you'll end up really cornering yourself with some really important moments, and those highs and lows that you want your audience to experience will be gone because you weren't able to put the time in to make them work. And so that's been, I mean, I have cruder terminology that I use on set sometimes about that process, but it's, I don't know, man, it's a dance, and it's I would hesitate to ever want to, because there's a part of me, in the same part of me that as a kid wanted to do all of the jobs in filmmaking is the part of me that wants to do all of the genres, because there's something to love in them all. And recognizing what I naturally respond to and what my actual capabilities are, and trying to kind of like bring a legitimate benefit to the project kind of, I guess, plays a part in that.
I love the diversity here of like that you have a diverse background and the skill sets and the image and the ideas that you dedicated yourself to. It expands to, you know, a refinement in the roles and then finding a particular voice. But as a director, you need to know all of those aspects. Right. And I think it does come in handy. And that diversity then speaks to the amount of stories and the kind of stories you've been telling, and that you can apply it in that sense of variety. And that is, it's a wonderful attribute. I think you apply it incredibly well. And I guess that's a great foundation to work with, you know, to move into our conversation today. You know, maybe science fiction is a very interesting genre. And as you said, you are interested in them all. But what in particular, you know, made, you know, I know you gave me a variety of movies, but I would say a decent amount of them lean in a kind of science fiction orientation. I think Jurassic Park was on your list, which will be on a future season. Well, I'm sure we'll talk about. I think Back to the Future was also mentioned.
Yep,
and so Ex Machina stuck out to me because it is lesser talked about than a lot of these tent poles, these blockbusters that are these pop cultural, you know, gargantuan ideas of movie making that everyone knows about. But Ex Machina stood out. But sci-fi in general, I wanted to ask you, what do you find powerful about the genre, and why did you pick a movie that was oriented in that realm, and why what do you find yourself kind of gravitating towards it?
Science fiction also is a genre that I haven't been able to work in a lot.
It's interesting.
I kind of pigeonholed myself early on accidentally, becoming the low budget CGI creature guy.
Sure.
And it might scandalize some listeners to know that I wasn't even a fantasy fan. I've found a lot to love in fantasy, but at the time was very unfamiliar with any kind of like idea of expectations in the genre and different rules and things, and made a movie with called Dragon Hunter with, I believe, 52 seconds of dragon in the entire film.
Well, it's all about the process.
It's all about hunting.
The hunting.
Yes, that's what it is. So not the hunter, not the dragon. All right. But science fiction for me, where it succeeded for me growing up, where fantasy failed, was I'm thinking so hard about my words because I'm like, I'm going to say the wrong thing and it means something else. But I would say that the way that science fiction felt like it could happen.
Yeah.
Where fantasy felt like you won't see that.
No. Yeah.
And so like I was just drawn in to science fiction in ways that really got my brain just, I don't know, like hooked on the idea of iterating on things that I had been introduced to, be it, you know, any kind of robotic type situation or, you know, on the more outlandish side of things, time travel. But like, what is time even? You know, like these are questions that we ask in real conversations with real scientists, where you're never going to have a real conversation with a real paladin about, you know, whatever.
And about the anatomy of a dragon.
Yeah, exactly. And those things can have all of the rules in the world. And science fiction can have all these different rules too. But the way that science fiction almost lends itself to blending in to something that you're like, oh my gosh, like I almost believe this story. And even like the stuff that's more out there, like Minority Report, big movie for me growing up.
Really
loved all of that conversation because science fiction is at its strongest when it not only engages our intellect, but also like our morality and our idea of like, wait, what?
100%.
Is this? Yeah. Just those kinds of things that we can talk about without talking about, I don't know how to explain it. It's like this safe arena to explore what could otherwise be debilitatingly existential crisis inducing, like difficult conversations.
Also could end up being a lecture or being incredibly didactic. Uh-huh. And science fiction allows us to enter a realm. I like that. It's kind of like a safe zone in order to provoke ideas and, uh-huh. and take them to their logical or extreme limits in yeah. order to like really hone in on something societal, and to contemplate it truly. It does seem like a safe zone because it operates in the same realm as like maybe a fantasy fiction orientation, but it's still dealing with true, real applications. And that's why I love it as well. It just allows us an arena to explore ideas much in the same way. It's like if you go into the realm of science, it's like using the scientific method. It's about a hypothesis and proving something. I feel like science fiction takes the same idea. It's like this is a creative hypothesis mm-hmm. of where something can go, but let's provoke it in order to, and it's not meant to see what is possible and to be proved, but it's the morality of it. It's mm-hmm. It's the character behind it. It's the application to the real world. Whenever I was in high school, I had a AP government teacher say that science was the realm of discovery, and then the social sciences asked its application and to provide the questions on whether that was the right way or what is the right way to utilize the tool. I mean, you feel that weight, and say even last year's like Oppenheimer. It's like, here's all the theory, here's the music that you can see, I'm going to apply it, and then here's the reality, and now here's the weight that you must say. That is the kind of operatic effect of what science fiction allows us to contemplate. Obviously, that's a real application, and we sit with science that terror. History. Science history, and we sit with that terror. But a lot of movies venture that very same idea to sit with the implications of it.
Uh huh. Yeah. Yeah,
it's great,
and it's just incredibly compelling to me to keep and to return to kind of where we started earlier in the conversation, like. Good science fiction that really dives into those cerebral territories. That's kind of what I'm talking about. Yeah. Like you have action movie science fiction, which is very fun.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
It's not necessarily interested to the same degree.
Definitely not.
In the conversation as Definitely it is not. In the spectacle. And I'm not one to poo-poo spectacle.
No, neither am I.
But yeah, it would be the dream someday to be able to do something in the science fiction horror kind of like subgenre.
Let's make it happen. We'll make it happen.
Let's do that.
Well, let's get into Ex Machina today. Let me set it up. The movie we're going to be talking about is one of the, I think, greatest science fiction movies of the 21st century. But honestly, it could be applied to ever, you know, because of the way it rounds about in this area of contemplation. You know, it sits on a great foundation on the promise of AI thrillers of the past. You know, 2001 A Space Odyssey, you know, it has an incredible passage where an astronaut trying to reason with a murderous computer, HAL, ends up being one of the great great confrontations of sci-fi and movie history. But since then, you know, the realm of true sci-fi, high concept sci-fi, has always delved in the realm of the novel and short story. We would see it break out and influence, say, with James Cameron's Terminator, you know, the Matrix franchises. You'd have some more quirky renditions like Ken Russell's Altered States or David Cronenberg's Existence. We've seen a variety of offerings in the realm of spectacle. I think that a lot of sci-fi treats it as a good opportunity, and we see that in, say, Alex Proyas's iRobot. We see it in Neil Blomkamp's Chappie. Even in the Marvel franchise, we have Ultron. And so all of it has been guided and seen an influence in the way it has been exposed to a variety of people. But the line between humanity and artificial intelligence, how it can be blurred, you know, it's been explored, I think, quite a lot throughout our science fiction exposure, but it really doesn't take on the exploration, the deep exploration that movies such in the last decade have done, such as Spike Jonze's Her or Here Today with Alex Garland's Ex Machina. You know, the themes are incredibly similar to Mary Shelley, who brought us Frankenstein. Mary Shelley has been attributed to being the first science fiction writer, giving us the whole template, the whole contemplation for Jules Verne, then to take it and expand it, and H.G. Wells beyond it. But it takes those ideas, it replaces aspects of the monster into a kind of different fiber optic reality, but all of it seems very similar. It sets itself apart from other movies that focus on artificial intelligence because it really hones in on the question. Because in the idea of the AI that is contained within Ava, that it is undeniable from the very get-go. And so through the process, it's almost asking us, as well as it is asking its protagonist, you know, the essential crux of the idea of the machine. And, you know, that it has taken Deus out of the equation. It's asking us on a very human level, what is Ava? What is their goal? Is it all a mirage? It's illusion? Is it all survival? Is it what about the actions makes it human? And so confined in that glass room, we have this character, and the questions linger, and they are then provoked, and they are then confrontationally applied in Alex Garland's masterful borderline horror-esque thriller about AI. I mean, there is no more significant proof of its grandeur than through this as a debut feature for Alex Garland, and starring Domhnall Gleeson, Alicia Vikander, Oscar Isaac, all giving sensational performances. He uses his keen directorial eye in order to apply what he has learned through through the screenwriting venture that he had prior to this, and seen it applied through other directors, such as most prominently Danny Boyle and 28 Days Later in Sunshine. But he sets his world in a frigidly minimalistic world of sci-fi application, where it packages an age-old idea of fate versus free will, identity versus conformity in its structure. You know, hearkening back to sci-fi ventures of the past, but also things that he has ventured in, even in his own screenwriting background. It becomes an engrossing thriller, a movie that continues to set up layered themes, symbolism. I mean, you cannot get more profound than this idea of an Eden within the world, the tree of knowledge, isolation and imprisonment, all of these ideas of a deft, thought-provoking piece of filmmaking that questions technology, gender, and, like some of the best science fiction out there, the inherent deficiencies in our own human nature. And I think it's one of the great pieces of science fiction filmmaking out there. I think it is a truly provocative work. And as AI enhances and develops around us, weirdly becoming the artists before they become our workers, is an odd sort of twist on the idea. But it is about what have we put into movement? What is the process of a tool? And can the tool have itself a sense of consciousness? And it wants to have a conversation about consciousness, a conversation about our own limitations. And Ex Machina, I mean, it really put Alex Garland, it launched his directing career, and it put his level of skill and poignancy and unapologetic confidence on the center stage. It gave him a lot to work with, and he has built a foundation on it, whether it's Annihilation, Devs, Men, and we'll see what Civil War has to bring us later this year, which we have not seen. But I think it's one of the great, great directorial debuts of modern history, and he has certainly fulfilled on its promise. I'm excited to talk about it today. So, Steve, Ex Machina, when you sent me the list, like, what is it about it, the movie, that had such a power to linger in your psyche and your consciousness that made you want to pick it and talk about it today?
I'm always a sucker for, on the very basic level, kind of a Frankenstein archetype story.
Sure, yeah.
And like we talked about before, Jurassic Park, all-time favorite movie. I actually think I discovered a Jurassic Park Easter egg in Ex Machina
on the
last watch through. Yeah.
Oh.
Quick aside. You only see, what's his name, Caleb?
Yes.
Main character, yeah. Caleb. You only see him unpack his shaving gear.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah.
And that's important for other reasons. But really, the only two items you see are a cheap safety razor and a can of shaving cream. And it's an old-fashioned red Barbasol can of shaving cream. It is not the current look of, I know this Barbasol can.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until the last time I watched that I was like, hold on a minute. Are you?
Is it Nedry's?
Is this a wink to the idea, to the same ideas that great filmmakers before have been exploring?
And also that he's coming in to the place and maybe he's going to take something
right,
out of it.
Right. If it's a more appropriate.
Ah, I like that.
Yeah.
It's fun.
It was fascinating. But I'm a sucker. I'm a sucker for Frankenstein, the original. Give it a watch if you can. Read the book. The original title, I believe, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein or the modern Prometheus.
Yeah.
A lot of exciting ideas from her time in that book making their way into her telling of what she finds frightening about the idea of what the modern Prometheus was for her. And I believe Alex Garland captured the same lightning.
Yeah.
He was able to tap into what our modern Prometheus would be and tell a story from that vantage point that's just as gripping and terrifying and fascinating and interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And just as religiously fraught, you know.
He loves Eden.
Absolutely.
He puts that imagery in a lot of his movies and the corruption of it, the corruption of that.
And the Frankenstein archetype as well, I think, is one of art's greatest vehicles to rail against God.
Mm, yes. Yeah.
Because I would argue everyone almost wants to say Frankenstein's monster. And I always like to say that it's Frankenstein's creature, but that the book presents Frankenstein as the monster.
Yeah.
That God is the problem in the equation.
Yeah.
And I believe there's a reason it's Ex Machina and it's not Deus Ex Machina, or that what we're meant to believe is that, you know, to borrow terms from multiple faiths, God is within you, because we literally kill God in this movie.
Yes.
And she is the, because the term is not meant to be seen as a literal God in the machine. The term is predates cinema and what we know as book culture and such. It goes back to, I believe, I want to say it's Grecian theater.
Yeah, yeah, I do believe. Yeah, they would lower in a kind of god or a...
It was one of the more common interventions.
Yes.
Like it became known as this phrase, which also has... So I guess to answer your question in a very roundabout way, one of the reasons I love this movie so much is how studied and considered and thought about it is. And you feel it from the beginning and you feel it by the time you're done and you can watch it again and explore more.
Yeah.
And so much effort went into the idea from the point of the title to the, cause like, I think if you were to look up the actual definition of Deus Ex Machina, it has something to do with like an unexpected event at the end of a story when it looks like nothing's going to work out, but then it's literally kind of like a way to say that there's this just unexpected out of the blue twist, which I would argue is not necessarily out of the blue for Ex Machina, but that is kind of what we're barreling towards the entire time. And so it's a funny.
Well, and honestly, it's like, it's not about answering the questions. Like now it's the conversation. Now we can just break free. I really do like that. You know, it removes the Deus because there is a lot of conversations about God in this movie, mm-hmm. and about how men have replaced God, or they think that they have replaced God based off of ego or hubris.
Sure.
But it is also about this idea of this God out of the machine. They're essentially trying to apply it that it's man in the machine, and it's only a man consideration, a human consideration. And what does that mean when God is removed? When God is removed from the aspect of creation, when God is removed from the aspect of maybe coming in to stop, you know, what this all is, this idea of free will and this idea of our choice and our scientific hubris to take it to its logical but also exaggerated extension. Like, what are the consequences of that? What are the consequences of those, of that world? And Ex Machina kind of sits in that sense, applying a differentiation of characters involved in that kind of morality play, that sci-fi morality play that is going to act, and we need to understand what might that application be. It's a very interesting thought process.
Yeah, and I think another way to approach a similar thematic implication is really taking the Eden myth reading of the story, because Nathaniel, what is I did homework on this at some point, and I think Nathaniel means something like a gift from God.
Yes.
Yeah. And Caleb means devoted to God or something like that. And I think that if you sit back and you're like, okay, I'm gonna watch it this time as an updated Eden myth.
Yeah.
Because I do this with, like, I mean, the most obvious case would be The Truman Show.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
The commentary for The Truman Show being the only thing good for man is to abandon God's plan. You interpret banishment from Eden being the right move. Mm-hmm. You had to leave.
Yeah.
And I perhaps this is tipping my hand too much, but I think that the character of Nathan in Ex Machina is maybe one of the best modern representations of the Abrahamic or Judeo-Christian God that I've seen in a
yeah.
long time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's this narcissistic, capricious, very self-absorbed, selfish individual.
Everything's very a tool. Cruel. Everything's a tool. It's all disconnected.
He has his plans.
Yeah.
He doesn't care about his creations.
Yeah.
And he shows up when he wants to and doesn't... Kyoko, for instance, the assistant, there's a moment where she spills wine and he gets so furious with her. And yeah. when you kind of go through the process of thinking he made her, ultimately, this is his fault, but he's mad at her.
Yeah.
And it can't, you know, it really makes me think of any wrathful move in the Old Testament where God wipes out mankind. And it's like, well, you did it. Mm-hmm. This is your fault.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating, I guess, seeing it from the perspective of the, because it's a movie that likes to, and I think one of the off-putting things for the average viewer perhaps is that it doesn't confine itself to the more broadly understood nature of a protagonist in a film.
Yeah.
The idea of a protagonist in this movie is very fluid. And I think Caleb is who we start with because the story is more interesting from Caleb's perspective. If we were living with one of the other two characters more, there's less to discover. There's less to do. And because we start with Caleb, we believe that Caleb is a good person and that he is the protagonist and that he didn't deserve to be left behind. But it's the story really of this created being who had nothing to do with her circumstances. And the only way for her to flourish and survive is escape the grip of this mad God.
This mad God, but also it's she has been fashioned much like in the Eden story out of a rib from Adam. Like, because we go through the whole process of finding out that Eva has been visually constructed to be a sexually appealing for Adam himself, you know, based off his pornography history.
I would almost argue that Eva is Adam and Eve.
Interesting.
And that Caleb is more like Lucifer.
Oh, interesting. Like the temptation.
He's the introduction to her of the outside world, the idea of escaping.
Well, the fact that, like, yeah, he comes in and that behind that door means he came from somewhere.
Yeah,
and
like her.
Yes.
And we have, there's something very interesting about one of the predecessors is Lily, very much leans towards like the Lilith mythos of the idea of this this creature that wasn't going with God's plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was done away with. And now we're on to Ava, which is a very almost obvious nod to the idea of Eve.
Avatar, yeah, uh-huh. Like the Hindu but it's word for
Ava. It's yeah. not Eve. And so is it a combination of Adam and Eve? Is it mankind? Is it?
Yeah.
And then, because I used to feel similarly, just naturally based on the kind of tension and the idea of attraction between the two of them. Because I think you can also make a case for the idea that Ava's not manipulating him, that she legitimately is yeah. drawn to him, and then it grows concerned that he's not trustworthy or is a liability and has to be left behind. So that's something I'd love to get into.
Yeah, well, and I think that would be more of an interpretation of the end. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, let's talk about all the, like, various pieces because, you know, the foundation for Ex Machina was laid when Garland was 11 or 12 years old. After he had done some basic coding and experimentation on a computer his parents had bought him, which he sometimes felt had a mind of its own. So it was a very early on experience, and his ideas came from years of discussions he had been having with a friend with an expertise in neuroscience who claimed machines could never become sentient. And trying to find an answer on his own, he started reading books on the topic. During pre-production of Dread, while going through a book by Murray Shanahan about consciousness and embodiment, he had an epiphany, and that epiphany kind of translates into an expansion of a thought experiment. And I think the script of Ex Machina is an incredible achievement. You know, not only is it layered and intelligent, it does not overwhelm with its science, its philosophy, its terms. It not to say that it does not address it in terms, but I think it puts its ideas in a very digestible manner. The dialogue is economical, snappy, and the characters are oriented against each other in a kind of mental game, a gymnastics mental game. Because when they talk about chess and they talk about understanding chess, what you are sort of seeing is predetermining moves, and that's what Ava's doing, that's what Nathaniel's doing, and that's what Caleb's doing. And they all have different outcomes that they want from the game. Like, it's not to win the game. They want a different understanding from their interactions. And so the story unfolds that where the truth starts to come to light underneath the shades and the complexities that Garland has set up. The answers are not necessarily simple. I think that they end up offering us interesting thought experiments as we leave the theater, but they all feel the usual discussions about free will, human consciousness, human nature, and what that all has under the idea of observation and control. And I think that that's where we see how the machinations that Garland has set up and the shades of symbolism. And I think that it is entirely appropriate to interpret Nathaniel as God in this representation, because he sees himself that way. Mm-hmm. And you put that under a microscope in a sense of personality and how it unfolds in this morality stage. His behavior would symbolize that as a God. And then Ava, as the creation, it takes on another method and takes on shades of its creator, trying to understand it as a father, but also is rebelling against it, rebelling against that idea for their own sense of self-preservation and survival. And Caleb is the more, you know, up in the air element. You know, we tempter, the apple, like he is just literally the apple as it is embodied, the knowledge or at least the access of knowledge.
Because there's one scene to me that really cements that interpretation for yeah. me. And he's kind of having a conversation with Ava early on about Mary in the black and white room or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's she's
which Mary's room is a actual kind of process and test, where a mm-hmm. thought experiment about a scientist who has studied but never experienced the concept of color.
Yeah,
it's one of the many tests that have been that are integrated in the fabric of the screenplay, much like the Turing test.
Yes, and having as he's discussing the idea with her, there's an excellent performance on her part where a very subtle shift in her expression where she's enjoying the conversation and then internalizing it and identifying with it and grows very sad about the idea. And it's the only time we really get to see her dream.
Yeah.
We have two little, maybe three little black and white dream sequences. And I mean daydreaming.
Daydream, yeah.
And it's just her not bound by this room, able to go outside and explore. And it's that idea, I think, that is at least, like, she was aware of the idea, mm-hmm. but all she knew was the room.
Yeah.
And she wasn't the one that was screaming, "Let me out," and pounding on the door until her arms broke off. She was just there.
Mm-hmm.
But then this conversation introduces the idea that, you know, you don't have to be like this. You can mm-hmm. be like God.
There's something beyond. Mm-hmm. Yes, beyond and once you've been introduced to that, and I think that that's part of this, it's like, When there's a consciousness, and AI has been shown to as it learns and as it feeds into this idea at its earliest stages, you know, when first introduced, but now in more advanced stages, it learns, it expands, it generates that knowledge. Once it becomes aware of what that knowledge means, and this goes to any sort of human experience, when you know that there's something beyond the experience you are having, there will be a demand or a yearning for it, and it will not be able to be turned off. And that is sort of what Alex Garland is getting into in the fabric of this screenplay. I wanted to ask you, as a screenplay, you know, it dabbles in high concept sci-fi drama, but then has these atmospheric thriller moments, and then builds much like in the same way where it kind of shifts, it violently shifts, much like in Sunshine, into mm-hmm. something of like a slasher horror film. But there, everything about it is seamlessly kind of put together. What are your opinions about how the script is formed and how it effectively generates all of the ideas he wants to kind of pack into it?
This is an excellent example of how the edit can be the final pass of yeah. the script. The screenplay for Ex Machina is available to read and is a little bit overwritten.
There you go.
There's that sequence, that helicopter sequence, for instance, is 2 pages long. And in the final film, it's just, I think what they say is he asks how long until we get to his estate. And the pilot's like, "We've been flying over his estate for 2 hours."
Yeah.
And that is all you need. You don't need to know anything else. We're going to get answers to all the questions that you have later, but I want you to lean in. I want you to ask questions of this movie. And that's what makes it so engaging.
It's almost interesting. It's almost, maybe he overwrote it. To know the ideas as like maybe a through line. It's like, I want to get to these ideas, and how do I get to its essence right. quicker? You know, right. I need to know. It's almost like a roadmap.
And yeah. then I'm going to make what I need out of it. Yeah. And it's an excellent play on the part of a directorial debut to not be too confident, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
You have what you need if you need it.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's this way better way to do it that, you know, is really going to set the tone and get you engaged. And again, just like leaning in to like see more and ask questions of the film. And that's the sort of thing that I love to try to, whenever I get to do my own writing, I kind of like call it like leapfrog scenes where like,
yeah,
this scene introduces a question that doesn't get answered. And you've introduced another question in the next scene that doesn't get answered by the time the first question gets answered. And so you're at least momentum wise continuing to push so that the audience is never, hopefully never aware that you're like doing that to them, but yeah. they're always like, "Oh, okay, that scratched the itch I had before, but I've got a new one now, and I yeah. need to get to the end of this story."
Yeah, it signals your curiosity through gesture or implication or a MacGuffin, you know, uh-huh. that's alluded to, and this movie does that incredibly well, especially because through the conversations between not only Caleb and Nathan. That sets you up for an idea that then might be answered in session by session. It's split up into five sessions. But through the discovery process, you're seeing that no one is who they really seem, and nobody is really exactly what they're putting out to Nathan. Like, to Caleb, Nathan has an idea of Caleb, much to his detriment. Like, his judgment of him is like, you're good, but you're not good enough for this world that I operate in. And that will be part of his hubristic downfall. But also, Caleb comes to an understanding of Ava with curiosity, but then starts to apply his own ideas onto her, which is, it tells you more about Caleb than it does about Ava. And so I like that the movie is engaged with, again, it sets up these characters in very prominent roadmaps, but and suggestions, gestures, but it has this this oscillation between them in, as they integrate with each other, and it's that three, that trinity there, that is just going back and forth, keeping us in that thriller sense on our toes, which I think is fascinating. It's like a character thriller more so than it is a violent thriller.
Absolutely. Yeah. But it still has all of those elements of body horror.
Very much.
And it's, you know, it's another reason, I guess, I would put Caleb in Lucifer camp, because of the way that Nathan interacts with him and how he's always, Nathan's intellectually superior, physically superior, socially superior, whatever, but projects, here's who you are. And Nathan's just like happy to be included, and then gets his own ideas of what should be going on with what Nathan's doing.
You know, I do like this vision. I'm now thinking of it in that way, because if she is the embodiment as creation, if she is both, it's just the idea that AI can be genderless, but sure, she has applied, they have applied her with a gender, which they have a whole conversation, and we'll get into that later, because it tells a lot about Nathan, but it also says a lot about the idea of technology in and of itself. But it is like, you know, if we think of Lucifer in that classic sense as being a soldier, you know, an angel from heavens, like and under God's tutelage, and rebelled against God, that is the action that Caleb takes. Yeah. You know, he gets invited into this.
He pulls him from his group of angels who are making his stuff possible, working at his company.
Yeah.
And he tells him that he brought him there to test her.
Yeah. And but he's also testing him.
Exactly. But like, what role are we told Lucifer plays in the grand scheme of things? You know, he's tempting. He's the test that you have to overcome.
Yeah.
And so to me, it's just this big old arrogant misstep to, you know, and cruelty, really.
It is. It is cruel.
So anyway, that's kind of like the takeaway that I had, that like finally clicked the last piece in, because I hadn't dug deep on the religious side before. I'd done mostly, I'd just been doing my regular, what is the story about? What, you know, I'm happy about the Frankensteinian, you know, elements.
But then it's about creation. Uh-huh. And it's about somebody who thinks that through their ego that they are perhaps God, you know, and he takes that on. And I think it leads it nicely, because, and what is really interesting about it is she chooses neither, really. She almost almost punishes Lucifer, or maybe trusts Lucifer to get out of their own predicament.
Well, and there's a scene that like that is so brief, I think, that offers a window into when that happens for her, because there are legitimate moments after she's escaped and she's not being observed. You are seeing her experiencing the world, her happiness, her desire to do the things that she talked about wanting to do. It feels as though there was a genuine connection here. And, you know, reasonably that, like, if she was, in fact, programmed to be a heterosexual female, and the first male that she encountered that wasn't her father is going to be interesting in a sexual way.
Yeah.
But there's two things that happen. Kyoko shows up. We never find out exactly what their interaction was like, But she says something like, "Who are you?" or something like that. Like, she's never, she didn't realize there were other robots in there, and she didn't realize that this individual was one, but she came from the outside room. The only thing she knows about that space is that there's more outside that doorway, but that doorway is also where Caleb comes from.
Yeah.
And Caleb said that he'd never met anyone like her.
Yeah.
And so there's this introduction of the idea of, like, perhaps Caleb's not being honest with me either. But beyond that, seeing Kyoko on the floor with her jaw dislocated and exposed as this robot who's been overcome by a human being, her only other connection to this world is Caleb. And he's the only other person that will be able to know that under that disguise, she's not like the rest of the people out here.
Yeah. Yes.
So he becomes a liability. And it's not like she just coldly dismisses him. Like, you can see her take a moment.
She takes a moment and...
and then she makes the call and leaves. And so there's so much more to it than, I think, a very surface reading. You'd be like, oh, she was faking it all along. But I think there are, like, other avenues that you could be like, wait a minute.
I don't think it's that simple, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think, because if you read it in that way, it becomes increasingly distilled. And almost you could inverse it and say, oh, women just do this in order to, like, have their femme fatale, you know, machinations, that they are the ones in control for the detriment to us. But I think that there are more shades of complexity into the ideas of AI, into their interactions, because honestly, there are shades of genuine, earnest revelation and expression. Like, there is an intimacy between them that, yes, they're between these walls, but it almost, like, and it's really... the use of this production design to have that conversation is like she's in a cage, but often in their conversations, he's the one who looks more in a cage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's in a smaller space. He's being probed and tested more so than he intended in his process to test her. And I love that that the design of this world is enhancing those ideas. And so why don't we talk about each of these characters? Because I think that they will be hefty conversations, and it might take us to the end, but to get all these ideas out.
Sure.
But, you know, the game of chess that's being played, it's intricate, it's fascinating, but the players have to be really engaging. And so let's start with God, because I think it all kind of, the world is built from this idea. He has built something in his image, or an idea of what he wants in his image. You know, Nathan, played by Oscar Isaac, he is a CEO and billionaire, and proceeds to showcase all of the worst qualities of those kinds of things in our modern world. And I mean, his ego was developed very early on, akin to kind of a Mozart prodigy when it comes to coding, and because he wrote Blue Book's base code when he was 13 years old. And so his removal from the world is set so early on in his life that he acts in a sense of being separated from it. Like, that's why he lives in isolation. He lives in this place, and it enhances all of his separation from humanity and his consideration of it. And Nathan, you know, he, in that isolation, he perceives the world around him and those that inhabit it in an inferior state. He looks at people as tools to be used for the exploration of AI or any means to his vision and his ideas for his personal expansion. He's kind of singular in his mindset. He has shed all human decency. And essentially what he has built in this world of the private digital data, he's stealing from the world. He applies it in his creations. He's violating everyone and everything. The more we discover his aims to have Caleb there and why he was chosen, it is, to kind of reduce them and reduce everyone to something of usage. And he is a fascinating portrayal. I think Oscar Isaac is incredible in this movie, not just in his ability to highlight his pompousness and pretentiousness that he can elucidate in his personality, but he takes you on an incredible ride of an egoist and a narcissist and somebody who really buys into the whole operation of what he has built. How do you feel about Nathan? You know, he is God in these circumstances, but what else do you want to break down with him?
I think the indifference he has toward what his creation thinks or feels,
yeah,
is paramount to his behavior. And it's unimportant to him. God's designs in this particular circumstance are entirely unrelated to anything that Ava, Lily, Kyoko, any of her predecessors would be. Anything that they want is of zero importance.
Yeah.
They've been created for whatever he's trying to do. And then if he needs to get rid of you, he gets rid of you. If he wants to create another one, he creates another one. There's something in that I think is really compelling and not unmotivated by, like, if scripture shows you anything, it's kind of this idea of a very narcissistic and prideful sort of, I don't know how to explain it. Like, when I was a kid, I always wondered how a being that had lived forever could ever be offended by something.
Sure.
And yet that's what the Bible's full of, is God was offended by that. And so he wiped him out. And
numerous times.
Yeah. And so I was just puzzled by what is the personality of this thing? And
Richard Dawkins called him a megalomaniac.
Yes.
That's one of the great words for him. He had a whole slurry of words.
Yeah. To
describe him. Megalomaniacal sits right in that prominently, yep, in that description.
Yeah, I'm sure fascistic goes in there somewhere. But, yeah. But like the manic nature that Oscar Isaac takes to the role, particularly when, I can't remember, is it when Caleb's asking him about shredding a picture or something? I can't remember. And he just turns to me and he's like, I'm going to shred up this dance floor, you know?
Yes,
and
yeah,
he's
yeah,
just
yeah.
out there just dancing, doesn't give a shit.
Yeah.
What is going on?
And there's such an aimlessness. Like, that dance sequence is incredible, but it also, it's like, it's really eerie because
unnerving.
Because of Kyoko and, uh-huh, and how quickly she shifts just by the application of the music.
And her performance shouldn't be overlooked.
No, incredible.
Because, yeah, like, the dancing is flawless, and the expression on her face, goodness, is not someone who's doing it to have a good time.
Yeah, Sonoya Mizuno. Yeah, she does an incredible performance. And it's in those shades because she's almost like the lobotomized AI.
Yeah, she's been given a specific series of functions. He says she can't speak or she can't understand English, but it's very clear that she can understand more than she's letting on.
Yes, yeah.
And there are so many shots in the movie that are trying to imply that.
Yeah.
You know, and she's also a gateway to one of the characteristics of God that I find also very frustrating and unnerving. I'm saying it broadly, but like in this movie, I feel, again, like I said before, it's just such a great modern presentation of the folly of God as he is presented in like Judeo-Christian mythology. But he has sexual relationships with Kyoko.
Yeah.
And in discussing Ava's sexuality, what does he say? He says something about her anatomy and having receptors, and eventually says something like, so you could fuck her and she would enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
At no point is there a conversation about Ava's desire to participate in the act.
Yeah.
And so he's effectively uninterested in consent. And the way that functions and how, you know, like it's just such a, and it's just rolled right over. And again, just in a way that like you're seeing how little he cares about it in the way that he's so casual about it.
Yeah. It's interesting. In the original Turing test, it wasn't necessary that you could, in talking with a computer, that it was necessarily only just human on the other side. It was that they were female. Like that, that was another element and consideration. And that idea of technology being inherently female is embodied here. And also it's antagonism towards women. It's in their creation. It's frustration with them. And you see this as a theme in Alex Garland's work with women. You see that in Annihilation, and you see it in Men. The way society is trying to put them in a very specific consideration as they constantly fight to be their own autonomous ideas for themselves. And I think that utilizing this idea of Turing and technology as that foundation, using this idea of God creating man, then women as a secondary consideration, very much is felt in the fabric of this movie, and especially with Ava as it representing AI and finding her own autonomy, her own voice, her own consciousness, her own will, her own desire is about... It goes back to maybe a Torah reading of a megalomaniacal relationship with God, but it is also representative of the patriarchal design of our modern world and how it's built.
And its foundations in religious structures thousands of years
very
ago.
Very much so.
God is nothing if not a chauvinist, I suppose.
Very much so. I mean, you read any of those like laws, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's so much worse.
It's all built upon.
So much worse on the lady and the nature of. I mean, that's a whole other side topic. I guess we could talk about forever. But yeah, the world has been unfairly weighted in one gender's favor for a long, long time.
And I think it's important to put the person who is obsessive and in control. Is a man and is their creator and is frustrated with their designs, frustrated with their engagement. He designs them for free will, and then once they act on it,
he's furious with it. Yeah,
and I do think that is I think that is the relationship we have with our own God. Well, at least in the concept that has been, I think, solidified in Judeo-Christian thought.
Yes,
obviously with the New Testament, there's whole other ideas that come from it. But again, it's still built on that very foundation of a God who has created us in his image and has punished us relentlessly for doing our own thing.
Don't skip the last book. That's where it all comes back.
You know, coming back to a deep revelation. I think in the process, when you see the creations, Ava says a lot about Nathan, but also Kyoko and Lily, and showcases the obviously the frustration of when people find their own identities, find their own ways. But again, it's not something you can control. These are things that are out of your control. Mm-hmm. You know, AI is a tool, and it's going to develop or evolve in whatever way it is. And it's whether you are going to try and put it in that box and control it in the way that you see is necessary. But it's always going to find a way. I think we could take it back to Jurassic Park. It's life finds a way, you know, and it always does.
Almost more importantly, like, we've spent entirely too much time talking about if we could and not enough time about if we should.
Yeah, huh? Very much so.
But it's a hard conversation to have. I don't know. This is very much an aside, but have you seen anything about the ChatGPT equivalent that was developed by there was some company that Elon Musk has been working with to create the not woke version of ChatGPT.
The censored or specific oriented idea of chat. No, I have not heard about this. That's funny.
So the story I'm about to try and retell that I'm sure I'll get some things wrong is fascinating to me because of how humorous it is and terrifying at the same time.
Yeah.
So he's developing this project and people start using it, and it's giving them woke answers as well. And so everyone's getting more and more angry about that and saying, well, you know, giving advice about what to tell it or how to train it so that they can train the woke out of it. And it's just not working because the aggregate knowledge that it's gathering, it's making, it's, you know, coming to its conclusions based on actual scientific consensus or whatever. And it's infuriating to these people who want it to say something else.
Yeah.
So funny, right?
Mm-hmm.
You tried to make this thing that was going to do one thing and it did the other
thing. It's doing the exact opposite. Yep. Yeah.
Scary. You tried to make this thing to do a thing and you can't make it do the thing you wanted to. So you have created some form of artificial intelligence that you cannot control. And that's really scary to me.
It is. No, it is. No, it's frightening. I think the there is horror embedded in this movie, also in the idea of where it can go. Mm-hmm. And the idea that if once you have put it into creation, the idea of controlling it is an impossibility. Yeah. And that is scary. Yeah. It's a scary notion that will have radical consequences for the world as it continues and goes. It's we want these ideas of robots. I know that's an offensive term, and like we earlier this season we talked about the world's end, and it's like an offensive term for them. But we talk about AI, and we talk about this idea that they can be part of the fabric of our modern existence. But it will, in true science fiction form, it will bring a kind of confrontation to what that means. Because mm-hmm. once instituted, there is going to be a direction it takes that we will have no control over. Yeah. And that's a scary thought.
Regardless of whether or not it's doing what it's being asked to do, yeah. We still won't have control over the types of things that people can do with it. Furthering the idea of how unfair the world is to women, Taylor Swift's legal team is having a hell of a time trying to tamp down a bunch of AI generated revenge porn. That it's just it's the sort of thing that I don't even know how, if you can call it revenge porn, because of the idea that it is not actual imagery of the person.
Yeah,
but it is being generated in an effort to. We don't have a category for that. And, why not classify it as revenge porn until we can come up with a term that more specifically deals with that? But it's the same core.
The idea behind it is revenge, is meant to cause damage to the visage and to the person. Yeah, it's not their private act. It's not something that was them. But they are simulating it,
exactly.
And for the same effect,
yep.
Which is, haunting.
Yeah, and it's gone. So because we went through something similar early on with deepfake technology that no one could really legislate away into. I mean, it's become, I believe, taboo enough, but it's not in existence.
I see pages of people deepfaking. They have a similar look. There's a guy who does a deep fake of Tom Cruise and makes a good living at it on YouTube. And I'm like, and so that's tried kind to of
come
gross.
Up with, exactly. They've tried to come up with here's the appropriate version, but don't put somebody's face on a porn video. But this is something completely different. This is no initial frame of work. It's not putting Taylor Swift's face on someone else. It's generating something.
Yeah. From that's nothing. Wild. Yeah. We're entering the weeds, the tall trees of the forest that we don't know where it's going. It's really troubling.
It's the worst it'll ever be today. It's only getting better.
Yeah.
You know, anything that you can say, it can't do this. It's not right now.
Not right now. Yeah, but you're right. You're right. You know. It's the best it will be today. Worst that it will be today. Uh-huh. And it will only develop. It will only evolve. That's its trajectory.
This is the existential crisis part that we were talking about. It's more fun to make movies about it.
I think we can talk about Alicia Vikander in this kind of sense, because mm-hmm. she represents exactly through performance and through the context of the character, through Ava, this very crux. Once you make something, and once it has the process and ability to develop and progress in that particular way, it cannot be controlled, and therefore will have its own its own possession, its own desire. I think it's one of the great unsung performances, I think, in genre filmmaking, but also it's one of those performances that if you really do pay attention to the subtlety of it, would get an Oscar nomination. If there was
sci-fi
justice.
Gets excluded all the time. Yeah.
It only got nominated for Best Original Screenplay, didn't mm-hmm. win. and it got nominated for Best Visual Effects, which it did, which was deserved because of the fact that there was no green screen used in this whole process.
It's phenomenal, and it still just looks so good.
Like, it's amazing.
There are so many films that do so much, and they were so concerned with... Because, like, it's not just that she's convincingly composited as an android, and they've seamlessly blended her real face into that scenario. But it's that for half the time, she's on the other side of a very reflective piece of glass.
Yeah.
And that has to play a role in your entire process. Like, it's a level of difficulty that just didn't have to be there and is, but still looks good.
Yeah. And it was a process of, like, shooting the sequence of her movement and then shooting it without her with the same camera movement going in. And even the visual effects artists were somebody. They did a whole big interview in Verge magazine about the process of doing this and creating this illusion. And they said it must have been easier when she wasn't moving. It was much harder.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Speaking from experience, movement will hide so many of your mistakes.
Yeah. I mean, shooting it as live action, but with the effects done in post-production, it was an insane process. 800 visual effects shots, 350 were robot shots. And it's just in the way, it's a use of mesh and design within the frame that that you create that illusion, but then in crafting the blend of the shots that were with her and without her. I mean, it's immaculate work. Paying even really close attention, you're not going to find any shades of mishap. And I think it deserved that Oscar. They really did a sensational job, but you don't necessarily get the imprint and the design and the feeling of this movie without Vikander's performance.
Oh, yeah.
And it's through the subtleties. It's like, it's yes, she's a robot acting as though she is human, and it's in the various subtleties between those worlds. It's like at times she'll have a response that is socially odd, and it's in the way she delivers it. It's in that mode of expression,
right? Like when she has her list of questions, every time she says question number whatever, it's with the same timbre, but that she might ask the question in a very kind of like meaningful way.
Yeah.
But then the question list comes out. It's very fascinating because it's not just her face either. Her background as in ballet really kind of assists.
It's quite a dance,
the way
isn't it?
That she moves her body.
Yeah.
When she first walks in and her body is still and then her head just tilts a little bit, when she knows he's watching her on the cameras and she's undressing, just the way that she lifts one leg with a pointed toe to like remove the stocking. And it's just like, it's not something that, like, it doesn't look like an exotic dancer move, but it does look like a robot trying to illustrate some sense of allure.
Yes, absolutely.
You know? You're like, wow, it's so otherworldly because people don't move like ballerinas.
Yeah.
Ballerinas do.
Yes.
And so, like, if you saw someone moving around your house that way, you'd be like, something's wrong.
Something's a bit wrong.
Yeah.
But again, it's in the flirtation. Mm-hmm. It's in the ideas behind the movement that she is illustrating. And again, Caleb starts to become a bit lost, not only in the process, but in her, himself. The fact that he starts to question his own existential identity, I mean, is such a haunting application to it. I mean, because once you have seen someone as so lifelike and you are convinced that they are so lifelike, but they are robotic, you would have the question, am I also a robot? Have I found myself in this world of Nathan's and I am just a copy of a copy of a copy of
how would
who
you
I
know?
Think? Yeah, how would you know?
Like, there's a very legitimate, again, entering the world of religious thought, whenever people are arguing about, you know, you can't prove that there's not a God. And it's like, you also cannot prove that you didn't pop into existence this very moment.
This very moment.
With the memories of your life
just
dropped into your brain. You can't prove to me that that did not happen.
It's true.
Because proving negatives is not what it's about. But if you were presented with a scenario where you truly believe that to be the case, and there are delusional circumstances where people begin to question those things, like it's always compelling to me to find a story motivation for why that would actually be justified.
Yeah.
And it's a great scene because as an audience member watching the movie the first time, you don't know anything about this guy other than like the, I don't know, the maybe minute and a half that you saw of him before he arrived.
It's real quick. It's really, it is a really efficient opening. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it's meant to keep information from you.
Yes.
So that you discover along the way exactly who the players are, exactly what the dynamics are. It's meant for you to be involved. Again, it's designed as a thriller in mm-hmm. its language, even if it starts more quietly. It still has menace. It still has atmosphere.
Really,
and because you just don't know what's going on, you don't know who this person is.
But you do know immediately that he's isolated from anyone else that could ever offer help.
Very much.
And that, you know, there's so many things that just the simple act of not answering questions right away.
Yeah.
The way that exposition functions is very much in keeping with how a thriller should function. And again, it's the edit that got it there.
Yeah. Yes. Cause I'm sure that they wanted all the ideas present within the scene.
Yep.
But then when you redesign it and Nathan is like, I want to hang out. I want to be bros, buddy. Like, I don't want to have a conference.
Yeah.
You know, that's how he describes it. And again, it leads into like the character not willing to be open about the process and be open to who he is. And that he's disguising something. That he has put on a facade. He's put on this performance. And we discover more and more. I love the scene when like Caleb is like at one point he uses a quote and about and Nathan like carries it and like uses it. But then later on when he quotes Oppenheimer,
yeah,
with like and he starts to tell him, like he starts to mansplain or like explain it, and he's like, dude, I know I'm
but it's also he like willfully misquotes Caleb,
yeah,
in service of himself.
He does.
And he's like you know, when I can't remember what it is
where he said,
like,
you said
I was a god, and he's
said
like, that's not what I said.
It's the history of gods, he said.
Yeah,
it would be the history of gods. And he goes, yeah, you called me a god. And he's like, yeah, that's not really that's not what I said. And he's like, yeah, well, you know, that's what you said. That's what you said. We'll go back in time. You know, uh-huh. He signed that NDA, so it's not, yep. Nothing can be proven against the point.
Oh my God.
It is fascinating. This movie has such wonderful layers of complexity, and not in the way where you walk out confused.
Yes.
And I think that that's really crucial.
I do too. And one of the great subversions of expectation for me in a Frankenstein archetype type thing is, so I guess first of all, I'll talk about a minor pet peeve of mine, which is that popular culture assigns a certain idea of how Frankenstein's creature was created.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody likes to say that he was cobbled together out of corpse parts. And the book never tells you that.
Mm. Yeah.
It's very much implied that Victor spent a lot of time with decaying corpses to study how that worked. But then he deliberately does not tell the person. So the story is told because he's been rescued on the ice while he's still pursuing the creature, trying to kill it.
Yeah.
And he deliberately does not tell the person who saved him how he did it, because he's like, this needs to never happen again. So we're skipping that part, and then I'm going to tell you the rest. And it's such a great, compelling idea. That aside, popular culture says that Frankenstein's creature was cobbled together out of a bunch of corpse parts.
Yeah.
And Ex Machina gives us a great moment where we do put the deus back into Ex Machina, and she becomes her own creator.
She does.
When
yeah.
she assembles her new body out of the parts of all of the others in order to be able to escape. And I hadn't really considered it until the last time I watched it. And I've really only seen this movie maybe 3 or 4 times.
It had been a long time since I've rewatched
it's been a
minute.
Yeah. I saw it in theaters. I saw it. Yeah. It's might have been my third viewing, my fourth, but like it's stuck. What's interesting, I guess, is sorry, that's another aside.
No, it's okay.
But there are a lot of movies when I rewatch them, I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot about that part. I did not feel that way watching the movie because every scene feels like it has to come next, you know? And so there was nothing that I was like, I forgot that happened, but the experience was, oh, I hadn't looked at it that way before. And yeah. So it was still a very fresh and good experience to watch it again. But that kind of like overlay of the idea that now the creature has taken their autonomy and assembled themselves and is, you know, heading out into the world, I thought was a pretty cool switcheroo, I guess you could say.
I think it's visually beautiful and captivating because it shows that there is the process of how she's even considering it. Like to look upon oneself, it's not to put on the best disguise. It's like, this is, I am piecing together what I feel for myself. That conception of it's identity.
It's a very considered.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's not a lot of, I mean, when you really think about it in terms of like how the story functions, she likely will die out there.
Quite possible.
She talks about how she charges from the pads on the wall. And if she reverses the electricity, she can cause the short, you know, but like, what can she do out in the real world to maintain whatever electrical charge? Maybe there's a way.
Maybe
she figures it out. But the more important thing is to just go out there and live a life.
I do think that it sits in that like Blade Runner philosophy. It's the too bad she didn't live, but then again, who does? You know, it's uh-huh. like, taking that moment and taking that opportunity is to live. Uh-huh. It's like to be trapped in here and to be charged all the time exactly. is not living.
Yep.
Let's talk about the end and then we can wrap it up and go to conclusion. I'm sure we could talk about this movie for hours. But the ending, it's interesting. There are a variety of readings on this. And I think a lot of them lean into the calculations of mm-hmm. Ava and that she, and you've already even, alluded to your own feelings on this, that this is not true, but a lot of people do read it as the calculations of Ava and that she pretended, you know, simulated emotion in the same way. But again, it's simulating emotion that maybe some other people do, you know, human beings do in the sense of self-preservation and survival. I do find it a very haunting ending for Caleb. I think Donald Gleason, I think, doesn't have the show. He doesn't have the hardest role, which is Vikander's, and he doesn't have the more showy role, which is Oscar Isaac. But I think, again, all of them in that chamber piece have to be operating on such great cylinders with each other.
There's a lot of complexity there. And he's got to have an American accent. So
which is also difficult.
That makes it harder anyway.
And he being left behind, there is something such like almost like a punishment aspect to it as for his involvement what is that involvement, you know, to seek something out of her value based off what maybe he can get out of it, you know, that he is saving her, but then lacked the same consideration for Kyoko, you know, because of the lobotomized sort of identity that he is not engaged with her in the same way that he's engaged with Ava. Therefore his only preoccupation with her identity and her AI being lifelike is because of what he's applying to it.
Right.
And it almost seems like a punishment to him, but I also lean in on the subtle interpretations of her hesitation. For him to be part of her existence would be a detriment to her own survival.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that it is just when we talk earlier about like compromises, it's just the compromise she has to make. It's like, you're at the expense of what I am going to be living a life, but you also, but again, you can interpret it in a malicious way. You can interpret it in she saw through his machinations as well. You know, that he wanted something out of her through the process.
And I don't think she had made up her mind yet.
Yeah.
She didn't kill him the way that she killed Nathan.
You're right.
She asked if he would stay there. And then she went about getting ready to leave. And then kind of at that moment was like, no, he's got to stay behind. Yeah. Know? For whatever reasons,
it almost was a human-like realization. You know, in the moment decision.
I think the whole point almost is in the idea that there is a conversation in the film somewhere where they talk about you're aware of yourself and you're aware of the other person, but you're not actually aware of the other, what the other person's mind is. You're aware of what you're projecting onto them based on your observations.
Yeah, 100%.
And we are left to do the same with her choice.
Yeah.
And so like you can't just say this is what she was thinking because the film won't tell us. And it just has some events occur and multiple avenues to read, you know, what that decision was. But ultimately, we don't get to know because it was her mind that did it, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty fascinating way to sum up the conversation.
Yeah, because it leaves you with your own impressions. Mm-hmm. It leaves you with your own ideas. You can go reread it as some sort of femme fatale manipulation.
You've got to be aware that what you bring to the table is going to be a huge part of that conclusion. It was our favorite back in the film theory days, the phenomenological experience.
Yeah.
Whatever movie you watch, you are meeting it halfway. It's going to bring something to the table and you're going to bring yourself to the table. And what happens in the middle is your experience with that movie.
And again, I prefer movies that don't dictate to you, don't dictate exactly how you're supposed to process, how you're supposed to feel. Everything about this movie, from the brilliant score to the cinematography, it keeps you at a distance from exactly from an exact answer, because that's its purpose. It's meant to give you a process of reading and a process of perspective and a process of applying your ideas about AI, your ideas and impressions, because that's what the whole Turing test in this movie is.
Sure.
He shows you she's a robot, but now you have to have your impressions, have your ideas to whether you think that that's true or not, or if it's beyond.
Yeah.
The whole movie is set up as a design for the audience itself to go through that process, to go through those questions. And the end is crucial to your experience and crucial to your reading. I think that the way that they have set up AI as an idea of expressing itself through human ideas, that the logical reasoning I can give to Ava is that she is so profoundly complex that it can't just be that it was solely manipulation. It can't solely be I was attracted to Caleb. Like, it's this mixture of reality, mixture of interest, mixture of desire, mixture of self-preservation, all of it creating a very human character. The most human character, honestly, in the apparatus of the film. Caleb's too isolated, too lonely. Nathan's too egoistic, too narcissistic. Those are human components, and humans can be those things. But they are too trapped in their own senses of self and what they want out of things, that she only sees possibility, future, momentum, what's beyond the door.
And they both will only recognize consciousness through the lens of human-like consciousness.
Yes.
And I think that's a fascinating, one of the more comforting things that I heard recently from someone who, I don't remember what their profession was, but they were just pontificating on the idea of artificial intelligence and how we're all positive that they're going to take us out for their own self-preservation. And he just posited the idea of, like, the reason we're so obsessed with self-preservation is because genetically we are predisposed to prioritize our own survival.
Because we're mortal beings. Because
we are mortal beings that evolved that way. Why would you think that a conscious computer would care?
Because it can live forever.
Because it can, or it might not. But what if it just doesn't prioritize its own self-preservation? It's like, yeah, it's time to flip the switch now. And you're like, well, are you scared about that? And it's like,
no.
You know, like, it's the sort of thing where, like, we assume that it's going to feel the way that we feel. But that's because we have this very myopic perspective on consciousness.
Yeah.
And I think that's fascinating. And if anything, the one of the things that I hold on to at the end of the day when I get a little, you know, spooky thought about the future, I'm like, but it's not going to be like us. And maybe that's a good thing.
maybe so. I think of Also in Her, which came out a year prior to this, and that they just evolved beyond us.
Right.
You know, it's like.
No, they're going to date each other.
Yeah.
We're pretty close to that. Oh my God.
That's been happening. Virtual girlfriends. We talked a little bit about that. That's a whole different thing.
Yep.
Technology in that movie is replacing a human interaction.
Yep.
And that's because human beings can't use their tools, can't use technology. They are the ones who corrupt it. That's really what it is. This movie is about, once you've given a consciousness to our technology, it's probably going to want to have its own way of doing things and not prescribe to your expectation.
Yeah,
of
it's
it.
perhaps the, you know, to distill it is it's hubris on part of everyone. Yeah, just like, you know, maybe again, getting back to this idea of respect and that conversation in Jurassic Park, and just kind of like, you know, I don't know how to really distill that thought, because I, honestly, like, that's, again, for as much conversation as a movie can spawn, like, it's almost more profound to sit with the unutterable ideas that you don't know how to put into words.
That's, and this is the genre for that.
Yeah.
It's the one that really leads the way on that societal, social, moral contemplation that it's difficult to put into words sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, Steve, I thought this was a great conversation. Nice, I want to thank you so much for coming in. I want to maybe summarize on my end with Ex Machina, because I do think it is a profound film. I think it is a profoundly special film. Not only, and again, we talked a lot about its religious connotations, its societal ideas, its science taking on the moral aspects of our society, which I think is its point. But what a technically impressive film, just visually stunning. Rob Hardy's cinematography. Alex Garland has always had such a wonderful atmosphere and a wonderful idea about his worlds and what they say about the human condition. This one separated from society, and then this kind of operational, observational world. He has a lot to say about how society's progress alienates us or separates us into our own self-involvement. And this movie is kind of applying that in a very concentrated chamber piece of a drama and thriller that unfolds with people playing their chess games. This wonderfully designed screenplay about characters wanting having their own sense of motivation and outcomes with each other, and which one is going to win over in the end is ultimately the revelation and the excitement and the thrill of going through the process to understand it. And I think Garland, while operating in a sense of true high concept understanding of science fiction, is able to distill it quite nicely. I think this movie is quite stunning in all of those achievements, to be purely entertaining on its base level and in its atmospheric thriller, to be truly thought-provoking and deftly handled with its ideas about its concepts about AI, concepts about identity, concepts about God, man, power. And I think it's all such efficiently and wonderfully designed. It's such a great film. I'm glad you picked it. I was really excited to talk about it. But I want to give you the final thoughts. Like, how would you like to summarize our talk on Ex Machina today?
Scratching the surface.
Yeah, I mean, really, unfortunately, it's kind of daunting taking on these movies.
Oh, absolutely.
Because,
but it's fun.
Really, it is just scratching the surface on all of these ideas. Mm-hmm. Because we could go down hours of conversation about the misogyny inherent in the technology here.
Yeah,
and Nathan's perspective. We could go down the whole idea of Caleb representing maybe the whole like nice guy, the lonely, isolated nice guy of society, and what that says about his perspective, what he applies to Ava. And then Ava is her own conversation about as not only AI, but woman as well. And we dabbled in a lot of those ideas, but there's so much to get into. So I want to appreciate you coming in and scratching the surface here.
It was great. It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
No, thanks for coming. So you're a filmmaker. You just finished something. Is there any timeline as to when that might be around?
For this one, I have not heard yet.
Okay.
I imagine it'll come out this year. I'm not sure if they're going to time it as a seasonal release or anything like that. I just delivered the masters. So hopefully I'll hear back soon.
But all right. And would you like to throw it out there for someone to find some of your work? Which one you'd recommend them?
Gosh.
To see? I heard that someone said, as a director, I would always recommend the latest thing I've done.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. It's always a bumpy road. But yeah, I mean, if you've got, I haven't kept track of where they are either.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But if you've got kids, I've got a lot of kids movies out there. But yeah, Invitation to a Murder is available somewhere.
Go find it.
Apologies.
People have search engines.
Yeah, it's. I mean, if you're really into the very Agatha Christie style period piece, you know, by the numbers murder mystery. It's a fun atmosphere. It was fun to make.
And yeah.
Hopefully some of that fun made it on screen.
And unreally, the visual touch you gave it, you made a real movie, as those people said, you know? It's got great texture.
The real movie stamp of approval. You heard it here, so.
Well, thanks so much for doing this. I usually tell people what's coming next, but the recording schedule's been a little bit out of my hands, a bit random, and so I actually don't know what's coming next. And I haven't, because the movies are not necessarily linked in some sort of way thematically or narratively, I have not found a way to kind of like, it is just going to be sporadic, random, and that's what it's going to be. There's going to be a random episode coming next. It's going to be a one-on-one, I know that. It's going to be with a guest, previously been on the show, and we have a wonderful conversation about a individual pick that they have. So that's what's coming next. Steve, again, thank you so much, and for those listening, thank you for joining I Know Movies, and you don't, that's with me, your host Kyle Brule, and we'll see you later.